And we hadn't gotten any more than about 5 feet onto the bridge when Dolly said, I can't walk across this bridge without remembering what happened here. I said, well, Dolly, let's step over to the side and take a moment and remember. So we did, and it turned out we were right there on the part of the bridge where the trees are, and that's just about the place where Ed Johnson was lynched. And we moved over to the side. We took a little time of silence, and then Dolly started praying. And she prayed for Ed Johnson, that he would rest in peace. And she prayed for his family, that they would find healing. And then she prayed for our community, that we come to terms with this and find healing. And I was struck to the heart. And I thought, you know, this is not past. It's not over. This is still alive. And we need to do something.
Eleanor Cooper and LeFrederick Thurkle are part of the Ed Johnson Memorial Project Committee, a group of citizens working together to create a memorial to an innocent young man who represents one of the darkest moments of our city's history. Eleanor and LeFrederick share the story of Ed Johnson and why this memorial is so important for the sake of our city and the healing of our community. This is the Camp House Podcast, and I am your host, Matt Busby. Well, Eleanor and LeFrederick, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. We're glad to be here.
Yeah. So today, I'm really excited to have you guys. We're going to be talking about the Ed Johnson Memorial Project, which, I'm actually kind of guessing a lot of my listeners have never heard of, unfortunately. So I'm really excited to get into this story, you know, especially now. Like right now, it's such a hot topic sort of as a cultural issue in our country right now, talking about memorials and monuments. And we're really going to be getting into a lot of that today. You know, but before really, you know, diving into that philosophical question about monuments, which we'll get to at the end, I think we really need to understand this story of Ed Johnson and who he was. What are we even talking about a memorial for? And LeFrederick, I've heard that you're the best guy in Chattanooga to sort of tell us the story. So who is Ed Johnson?
Well, Ed Johnson was a 24-year-old African American male who was accused of raping a 21-year-old white female back in 1906, and of course, throughout the court trials, it was proven that he was not at the crime scene and had 13 witnesses to come before the courts to prove that he was not there. And through the appeals of his attorneys and eventually the Supreme Court's decision of a stay of execution, Ed Johnson was still dragged to the Walnut Street Bridge and lynched from the second span of the Walnut Street Bridge. And so we honor his life because of the innocence. And we honor him because of the impact that this case had on the American justice system. And we also honor the case because of the contributions of two African-American attorneys who made history by being the first African-American to serve as the lead counsel in a case that was heard before the Supreme Court. And then this case is historic because it's the first time in the United States Supreme Court history where they intervened into a state ruling and found the sheriff in contempt of court. So Ed Johnson is the person who's at the center of all of this. Ed Johnson was a native Chattanoogan who grew up part of his life on Missionary Ridge and then later relocated down to the west end of Main Street in a place called Red Row. And he was a laborer, had a little of amount of years of education, and so he was known in the community as a good guy and a person who'd come from a good family. And unfortunately, you know, due to, I guess, being in the wrong place at the wrong time, was falsely accused by a 22-year-old guy who was searching for an opportunity to get his hands on the reward money.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to, in the show notes of this episode, I'm going to put all kinds of links about this story. I mean, there's write-ups in the New York Times. Your guys' own website does a fantastic job of sort of talking about this story. And that would be edjohnsonmemorialproject.com, correct? Is that the website?
Yes.
And so, yeah, I mean, when you guys go online and you read about this story of what happened to this young man, it's truly heartbreaking. But I do kind of want to push you a little bit further on some of the details of this story. Yeah, very clearly, you know, I think this is one of those cases where there was, I mean, there couldn't have been justice because there was so much mob anger over everything right. that happened. And that even there was an incident even in the middle of his trial where a juror like threatened to kill him, correct?
Right. And it was simply because of the fact that the accuser, Nevada Taylor, could not definitely or identify the person with certainty. Mm. And, you know, the juror asked her, "Are you positive that this is the man who did that?" And she was still unsure. And he just said, out of anger, if I could get my hands on him, I'd rip his throat out. And so.
Yeah, and so what ended up happening is, the judge seemed very unwilling to even give him a fair trial or to hear any kind of appeals, correct?
Correct.
And that's what ended up leading these two African-American lawyers to take on his case. They took it all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States. And like you said, this was the very first time in the history of our country in 1906 that they actually say that part again. What was the landmark there?
That an African-American attorney was the lead counsel in a case that was heard before the Supreme Court.
Okay. And then they stayed the execution.
Correct.
And what happened sort of the next day after that ruling came back to Chattanooga and it was known that the Supreme Court was not going to allow the execution or they were going to stay the execution until there was a fair trial. What happened in the city at that moment?
Well, at that time, the mob who'd heard about the Supreme Court's decision felt that the Supreme Court had no right to intervene into the state's ruling and that the local courts had made a decision and that should be upheld. And so it was a way to say to the Supreme Court, how dare you get involved in our case? How dare you tell us how to deal with this case? And so it was an attempt to show the Supreme Court that they were in control. Mm-hmm. And it was an attempt to say to the Supreme Court, stay out of our business.
And so that night the mob came down to the jail. And talk us through that scene, because there's clearly was some collusion with authorities, or at least according to the Supreme Court.
Right, and you know, there had been a mob that had showed up at the jail a couple of nights before, and even on the night of the incident, there was a mob that showed up at the jail thinking that Ed Johnson, or the person who was guilty, because they didn't know a name at that time, and there was another arrest prior to Ed Johnson's for the incident, but the mob was unaware of that, and it was when the mob was out in front of the jail and one of the jailers said, "Ed Johnson is not here, he's in Knoxville," that the mob have a name that went along with a suspect. And so again, the mob left and again come back when Ed Johnson was there. And there was the sheriff gave all of the jailers the night off and moved all the other prisoners off the floor with Ed Johnson. And there was one inmate there, a female inmate who had been arrested for selling bootleg whiskey, if I'm not mistaken, and her name was Ellen, and she was the only one on the floor with Ed Johnson when the mob broke into the jail. And of course there was only one jailer there, and I think he was an elderly man. And the sheriff, when he heard about the mob at the jail, decided to walk down McCauley instead of taking his horse and buggy down to the jail, I guess to prolong the time and allow the mob to do what they had intended to do. And I think that the sheriff knew about that and, of course, wanted to say to the Supreme Court himself, well, you know, this is what happens when you intervene in our business. And and so, which is why he was later found in contempt of court, because they felt that he didn't do enough to protect Ed Johnson, and he didn't do enough to make sure that his safety was guaranteed. after this day of execution.
Right, and so after this entire episode, this was the very first time and I think the only time in U.S. history that the Supreme Court took a criminal case and held the sheriff of Chattanooga in contempt of court. Yeah.
As Leroy Phillips, one of the co-authors of the book Contempt of Court, would say, it's our dubious honor.
Well, okay, so the mob, I just want to continue with this story a little bit so my listeners understand what happened. You know, the sheriff knew a mob was coming after Ed Johnson, despite orders of the Supreme Court of the United States to protect him. So he clears the floor, has minimal staff, and the mob eventually gets him out of there. And walk us through what happens next. And I know this is really tragic, and I really encourage my listeners to go out and read this story, but I really want you to hear what happened.
Well, after they broke him out of the jail, of course, they put a noose around his neck and led him up to the Walnut Street Bridge, where they then took one of the cable cars, rails, or the cables from the cable car, and used it as the noose that they would use to string him up on the second span. But before they did, they talked about him and called him all kind of names and treated him really badly as they walked him up to the bridge, taunting him. And once there, they, a crowd of people, even the onlookers who came along with the mob, were there to see this happen. And so they, of course, attempted to string him up. But before they did, they said, well, you know you're going to die for this crime. Do you have any last words? And Ed Johnson looked at them all and said, God bless you all. I am an innocent man. And after that, they strung him up by the cable car and began shooting at him and riddled his body with bullets. But one of the bullets severed the cable, and his body fell down to the ground, and he was still moving somewhat. And one of the local police officers came over and reloaded his revolver and shot him in the head 5 more times. And then one of the members of the mob penned a note to him saying, basically to the Supreme Court, here's your N-word nigger now. Come and get him, now you can have him. We've done what we needed to do to him. Now he's your prisoner.
Wow.
And his body lay there on the bridge for over an hour or more afterwards. And eventually the Franklin Strickland Funeral Home, or Franklin, mortuary at that time, came and retrieved his body and prepared it for burial.
So now here we are today in 2017, and you guys have put together a committee, or you're part of a committee, that is looking to create a memorial for Ed Johnson. LeFrederick, why do you think it's important for our city to remember this episode of our history?
Well, I think it's way past time that this happens, and it's ironic that it appears to be a part of a wave of movements across the country where these kind of memorials are starting to spring up in honor of lives of people who experienced injustice. I think that there have been, I was a part of another group with Leroy Phillips and the Morris Ford Foundation, and groups in like Duluth, Minnesota, and Rosewood, Florida, and other areas that already began to honor people who experienced injustice in their lives. And so a part of that process that already began. However, I believe with the time that we're in now, it just became organic that people became more conscious of the need to build on race relations instead of allowing whatever it may be, politics or political views, to separate us. When you think about our country being the United States of America, mean that these states are united and that we should be a united country and we represent a united place in the world. Where else is a place called the United States of America? Mm-hmm. And in that mindset, we've come past or through this time in our country's history where we were separated. It's way past time for us to truly become the United States of America. And in that, you know, my personal opinion about even Confederate statues is that, you know, I don't believe it's right to take them down and destroy them. They have a rightful place in American history. Just like monuments that honor slavery have a rightful place in American history. It's part of our story. It's part of our fabric. To take it away or to deny it to be created is denying our story. Whether you take them down or you deny them to be erected, you're denying the story.
Well, LaFrederick, why are you so personally invested in this effort?
For several reasons. I became personally invested in the process of cleaning up the cemetery after I found out that I had a relative there in the same cemetery where Ed Johnson is buried. And so I committed my life to making sure that we honor those people who were buried there through making sure that we keep the cemetery clean, we honor them by, you know, preserving the cemetery. And then just through the tragedy of Ed Johnson, you know, as an African-American male, can relate to our people's past of being wrongly accused and unjustly treated. But also, as a young black male living in today's time, or a middle-aged male now, I think, you know, but just being an African-American male in this country, you know, we were always taught that you have to be extra good, or you have to be extra careful, or you have to be always mindful, and just to know that this happened in 1906, but in 2017, there are things still happening that represent and are just as horrible and tragic and yet equal to the tragedy of Ed Johnson. And so I believe that it's my responsibility to make sure that we continue to tell the story of Ed Johnson so that we can prevent these kinds of things from happening and always bring to mind to the consciousness of the people the injustice of when these things happen.
Well, Eleanor, you know, it seems like right now monuments are such a contentious issue within our country. And, you know, I was hoping you could speak to that a little bit. Why do we create monuments to begin with? And what should be some of the reasons we have monuments within our civic spaces?
Well, let's think about two things about monuments that are different from statues as such. The first one is that monuments are collective in nature. In other words, it's something we agree as a culture that we want, that we value, or we want to remember. And the other thing about monuments is stone. They are not necessarily made of stone. They may be made of something else, but it's still that idea. They are cast in stone. They are permanent. They are big. They are important. So those two things combine make monuments different from what we might call public art or statuary or, you know, the other things that we see in the public eye. Monuments hold a civic place. They hold something, some space in our civic culture that says these are important.
Yeah, yeah. Let me read this quote. There's a theologian that I'm really interested in because he talks about sort of the cross-section, and I think my listeners know I'm a pastor here, a cross-section between theology and public spaces. It's kind of like a big topic right now, which might sound unusual to a lot of people. But here's this quote about monuments in particular. Traditionally, monuments have been physical objects invested with special meaning for the people of a particular area. Objects are somehow elevated above ordinary objects in importance. And I really like what he's getting at there because it seems like these monuments are sort of endowed with a special meaning that matter to a particular people. And I think that's part of the issue right now.
That's right. That's right. That's what I was meaning by the collective nature of it, that it's usually a decision of the community or a collective decision that this happened. So that's what I mean by endowing. There's usually a dedication. People come together. There's an invocation, and you know it's endowed with something special to the community.
Yeah, and I know you've recently actually kind of written about sort of the contentious nature of monuments in our country right now, and specifically all these Civil War monuments that people are talking about. And I was hoping you could maybe mention that a little bit.
All right,
so what makes those Civil War monuments that people are so upset about right now sort of different from essentially the monuments you just described? Like when we create monuments within our communities, we come together as a public and put those up as something that's from the collective. Was that the case with some of these Civil War monuments?
All right, let's distinguish between Civil War monuments and these ones that are in the crosshairs of the public
please,
right now.
Please.
Yeah, that's really important because here in Chattanooga, as you know, we're surrounded by monuments, Civil War monuments. They're all over. The Battle of Chickamauga was honored by the creation of the Chickamauga-Chattanooga National Military Park, which was the first national military park in the nation. It was in 1890. They decided to preserve that field because so many people on both sides were killed there. So it was a way of honoring both sides, right?
Yeah.
So this is part of our national history. This is not Confederate history, right? That's the distinction. It's part of our national history. So when they had the it was passed by an act of Congress. That's another thing. It was a collective will, right? Act of Congress. Couldn't get higher. And then in 1894, they dedicated the park. And at that time, veterans are still alive, obviously, from both sides came, from the North and the South.
Wow.
So it was a huge reunion.
Moment.
Yeah, it was a huge moment. It was a national moment to, in a way, to put this behind us, but also to honor those who died. You know, so many in our nation, the men, population of men, both North and South, died in that war. So this was a huge thing.
So it was a real moment of catharsis and reconciliation for everyone involved.
And they said it was like a reunion, like when the veterans came, even North and South, they were hugging each other and talking about, well, this happened here and this happened here. So it was something you can't quite imagine, different from our like college or high school reunions, you know. But okay, so that's not only the Battle of Chickamauga, but the Chattanooga National Military Park also includes Moccasin Bend, Lookout Mountain, and Missionary Ridge. And Missionary Ridge is very long.
I live all kinds of places along Missionary Ridge.
Yeah, I live near on the side of the ridge, and you know, every few feet there's another plaque indicating who fought there, how many died on both sides. So those are different. That's not what we're talking about right now. That's
right.
Not what's in controversy.
So so we have those sort of in one hand, and in the other hand, we have these statues and monuments like the Robert E. Lee one that caused so much controversy in Charlottesville.
Right.
So talk about the different process with that Robert E. Lee one, because I know it was created in a very different process than what you just described, an act of Congress, right? And both sides kind of coming together to dedicate the space, these monuments. Sort of tell me the story behind the statues that are like the Robert E. Lee one.
All right, most of those statues, let's call those the Confederate general statues.
Okay.
Though they may be other things, most of them are Confederate generals, and maybe one that was special to that area where it is. But most of those were erected by the United Daughters of the Confederacy. Now, this was a small group of women, originally about 30 women in Tennessee, started this in 1894. So about the same time, about the same time as that reunion of the North and South for the Chickamauga Park, about that same time, there was a feeling in the South, well, we want to honor our own heritage, our own fathers, grandfathers. At that time, it was just fathers and brothers who fought in the war. So, but they couldn't, you know, the men couldn't erect statues to themselves, right? So these women formed this group, and it spread really quickly throughout the South, even in the North. And their act was to create a monument in their town to the Confederate side. And they usually did that by recognizing a general who was important in that state or that town. So those spread rapidly. There were over 1,000 erected in a very short period of time.
Yeah. But I think the huge difference that you're describing too is this was a public thing when it comes to the battlefields around Chattanooga versus this private group of citizens who erected these Confederate general statues.
That's right. And not that that's wrong.
Right.
But just notice the difference. The private group erecting those statues often did not have a public debate or approval of community approval or any kind of collective will. It was more an act of their efforts. Plus, they often got support from the local government mm-hmm. because there was, cooperation there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, there was a certain, it was totally controlled by a white population.
That's right.
At that time. Yeah. And so, yeah, so I think that's the big difference. And what's really interesting about this current cultural moment when we're talking about monuments is really what monuments are meant to symbolize is a sort of collective will and a collective consciousness and even the values of a community. And today, what we're running into is there are a lot of monuments and statues around our country and around our communities that don't represent that collective will and that collective consciousness. Do you think that's the tension we're feeling right now?
That's the tension we're feeling because those monuments are in public spaces, sometimes a very civic space, like in front of a courthouse or a federal house, sometimes a park that's very important to the community. So because they're in those public spaces, they appear to have the collective will, but they actually don't. So therefore, people are now saying, hey, that doesn't represent us. So I really think the way to address this at this point is through a community dialogue, through conversation, through and not necessarily a public forum like a big event, because that just opens it up for conflict and tension, but in small conversations, smaller groups hosted by churches or community organizations to say, what does this mean to us, and what do we value, and what do we want here in this public space?
So why do you believe that it's important for us right now in Chattanooga to create this memorial for Ed Johnson? Kind of the discussion that we just had as far as public statues or monuments or memorials even kind of speak to the collective consciousness of a people, especially in something that's going to be such a public area as the Walnut Street Bridge. Why is that important for us to remember? I guess what is your hope that statue will sort of spark?
I hope that statue will spark a reconciliation, a healing, a coming together of both black and white to say, let's shine light on this part of our history. Let's bring truth, and let's look at this in the context so that we, here's my vision. I hope that on the day this memorial is dedicated, that we will have a large gathering at the bridge, both black and white, honoring and celebrating that we have, as a community, acknowledged this part of our history and have been able to come together and create this memorial. I think that would be a fabulous thing, not just in because we are creating something. We're creating something positive and creating a place where we can reflect and remember together.
Yeah, I love that, having this almost physical representation of hopefully a city that's reconciling with its own past and able to, move forward together, and having a symbol of that within our city, I think is really, really beautiful. And I agree, I hope that's what happens.
I wanted to tell you a story of why this is important to me. I have a friend named Dolly, African-American friend, and we were just getting to know each other at the time, and we decided to walk together. We both like to walk.
When was this?
About 2 years ago.
Okay.
And so I suggested that we meet at Rembrandt's and go from there. And so we walked down, headed down towards the Walnut Street Bridge, and we hadn't gotten any more than about 5 feet onto the bridge when Dolly said, I can't walk across this bridge without remembering what happened here. And I knew what she was talking about because I'd read the book, Contempt of Court, and I knew the story, but I was stunned, actually, because it was over 100 years ago, and I didn't know that that would still be so present. So I didn't say that. I said, well, Dolly, let's step over to the side and take a moment and remember. So we did, and it turned out we were right there on the part of the bridge where the trees are, mm-hmm. and that's just about the place where Ed Johnson was lynched. And we moved over to the side, we took a little time of silence, and then Dolly started praying. And she prayed for Ed Johnson, that he would rest in peace, and she prayed for his family, that they would find healing, and then she prayed for our community, mm-hmm. that we come to terms with this and find healing. And I was struck to the heart, and I thought, this is not past. It's not over. This is still alive, and we need to do something. So after that, Dolly and I continued on to walk, and we told our own stories of, and got to know each other. And we have been walking every week since then and become very good friends. And when we heard that a group was working on the Ed Johnson Memorial, I went to Dolly and said, Dolly, let's get involved. This is something we ought to do. So we're both involved in it now.
That's beautiful, Eleanor. I guess that is my question. You know, I can see how this whole effort can bring up a lot of pain on one side and a lot of anger on the other. And so have you guys experienced a lot of backlash from both of those sort of camps, from people who would feel incredibly wounded by even thinking about this, and other people who are just angry that you would even bring this up?
I think we have touched all those feelings in different ways. And one emotion that you didn't mention is the anger that white people have.
Well, that's what I meant by the anger piece, and the hurt piece coming from the African American population.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. Yes. That is. Many whites are very angry that this happened, and that and both white and black in many cases don't know the story.
Yeah.
And in some cases it's sort of back there, but hasn't really come to the fore. But when we have a documentary now, it's just a rough cut. We're building to do the whole thing, but it's a very nuanced and complex story. So we're really excited about producing this in full and giving this to the community so that we can all learn and see the more in this story than just the one thing.
Well, yeah, that's incredible, and I'm really excited for our community and for the like you said, the conversation and the dialogue that this has to open up, right? I mean, first of all, you are replacing the dog statue that everybody knows, right? It's going to be right there where the dog statue is, so everybody's going to see this, and it's going to be some incredible conversations.
Well, actually, Ed Johnson Memorial is not going to replace the dog
statue. Oh, okay.
Statue. Yes.
Well, they're moving it, right?
They're moving it anyway because that plaza right in front of the Walnut Street Bridge is going to be redesigned and reshaped, and so it's going to cut through the area where the dog is now.
Okay.
So that's real important because the dog is very
special. I knew they weren't getting rid of it. I thought maybe they're moving it. But yeah.
They will. They'll move it somewhere else on the plaza.
Okay.
So. But there's another story I want to tell you, and this is about my connection to this story through my own family. My family has lived in Chattanooga since the founding of the city. But when I read the book Contempt of Court, I was surprised to find my great-grandfather mentioned in the book.
Wow.
And I did not know this story about him. Now, he was a minister. He was a young man during the Civil War, a young minister then, and he and his wife did not support the war. They did not support secession, but they also didn't think the North should attack, so they tried to be neutral. They said they would stay here in Chattanooga and serve whoever needed their help as a minister. So they did. They served both armies when they came through. They ended up being a hospital to both, and a hospice and a headquarters at one time. One time they had a Union general upstairs and a Confederate captain wounded downstairs without knowing. So anyway, that's the kind of person he was. He was a man of God who tried to live his faith, all right? So we fast forward to 1906 and the case of Ed Johnson. He was an old man then and retired from the ministry, but still had that presence. So when the mob first was going to, it was known they were probably going to attack the jail, he went down and he stopped the mob.
Wow.
But the night they came and got Ed Johnson, he was out of town. And the author of the book says that if he had been here, it might not have happened.
Oh, that's incredible. That was your grandfather?
That was my great-grandfather,
great-grandfather.
Yes.
What was his name?
Thomas Hook Macaulay.
Okay.
The Reverend Macaulay. He was at First Presbyterian Church. So you can imagine how stunned I was to read that story. And Then the second part of that is when the lawyers, when Noah Pardon, one of the lawyers for Ed Johnson, went to Washington to see the Supreme Court, he knew he was going to be gone overnight and that his wife would be in danger. She could be attacked or the house could be burned or whatever. So he was worried for her. And the Reverend McCauley took his wife overnight his home so that he protected her. That just shows the kind of moral character and willingness to stand out. He knew he was protected, or he felt he would be protected. So I read that, and then I felt convicted. There's no way I could not work on the Ed Johnson story.
Yeah, it's such a part of your heritage.
That's right.
This whole story. That's amazing. Well, I know you guys are at the point in this whole process where, as far as I know, all of this is approved, correct? For you guys to put the memorial there near the bridge?
Yes, it's approved, but we're in the process of raising money from both the city and the county, and
okay.
So I can't say for sure until that's approved.
Yeah.
The city passed the budget this week, so Ed Johnson was in that budget. So the county's next, and once that has been approved, I think we'll go.
Okay, great. And then I know you guys had put out a call for artists, and I believe this week you guys made a decision on who the artist is going to be who's going to create this, right?
We had the selection process. The selection committee met this week. There were 45 entries from all over the country.
Yeah.
And even from some foreign countries, the UK, Brazil, Canada, all submitted. They were wonderful, wonderful artists. And it's not just artists. It's a design team. So it'd be landscape artists and maybe even architects. Because the space that they're going to be working on is not just that space beside the bridge, but it also goes down the steps all the way to the riverfront. So it's a big area and requires some real thinking about how to work this. So we require that they be a team. We narrowed those 45 down to 3, and they were announced just this week. And then they are coming back. All 3 of them will come together in November. And we will have a public meeting. People can come and see who they are, and that we want this to be a public input. We want people in the community to say what they want this to be.
So there won't be any mock-ups at that or anything like that. It is just meeting the teams for the teams to be able to hear the community and then go back and create a design.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. They have to hear the community first.
Yeah.
Then they will come back in February with their designs. And that will also be open to the public to come and see and comment.
Yeah, that's great. So the public will have plenty of opportunity to sort of feed into this, some of the emotion, the ideas, and kind of those dreams that you were talking about. Like, hopefully this is a moment of reconciliation for our city, or of at least dialogue and conversation, and hopefully all of that will feed into what this final design is going to look like.
That's right. We want the artists to get a real feel for the community. We want them to see what this means to people. To people to be able to express how they see it and what they want to have happen there. So this will be a important time, and we'll let you know then when there's a chance.
Right,
for people to come
out. We'll put a little commercial in the podcast so people can be there in November for that. Something I've actually been wondering. So who are these people creating the Ed Johnson Memorial? I know you guys have a committee. Tell me about that. Tell me how it was formed. How long has this been going on?
The committee formed about a year and a half ago, and it's individuals, many of whom had been working on something related to Ed Johnson for a long time, like LeFrederick just expressed his interest in the cemetery, and Linda DuVoisin had been working on a documentary. So some people had been involved for many years, but most of us were drawn to this when we heard there was going to be a memorial of some kind. So we gathered together. We continued to grow. We vary in age from 20s to 80 years old. We are black and white, and we very intentionally do everything with that kind of mix, a black-white mix, and also age range. Because we want this to be something that touches everyone in the community. The black-white mix is very important to us. We feel like this should be created by both, and every event we do, we host community events around the community, showing the documentary and asking for contributions to build the memorial. And we have a black and white host of those events, and therefore the audience is usually mixed also.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that sounds like it's probably a really important thing that you guys are hosting this both with there's a black and white host, because I could imagine how uncomfortable watching that documentary could be. And the fact that you have both black people and white people representative within the committee that are there presenting it probably diffuses a lot of those sort of really negative emotions that could come up, or fear even.
We have the host always speak about why they care and why they're doing this and why they want to give to it. So you hear a black person tell his or her story, and then you hear a white person tell his or her story, and it's wonderful. It really touches you because it makes you realize this is now. This is us. This is contemporary. It's not just something in the past, and why we care about this.
All right. Well, Eleanor and LeFrederick, thank you all so much for being here.
We enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much to Eleanor and LeFrederick for coming on the podcast to share about the life and legacy of Ed Johnson. And thank you to everyone working on this committee to help bring this memorial to life. In the show notes of this episode, I created a couple different links that I really encourage you all to check out, including one for the Ed Johnson Memorial website and others that share the full story in depth of this tragic moment in our city's history. I know I always encourage you guys to share these episodes with a friend, and we really want this to be a resource for folks to be connected and informed about what is happening in our city. And I want to make that request especially for this episode, not so that people can understand what is happening, but what has happened in our city. Before learning about Mr. Johnson's story, I had no idea that there were people in my community who viewed the Walnut Street Bridge as anything other than a treasure of Chattanooga. And now I know and understand that there are brothers and sisters in the city who tremble at the sight of it. What I see as a symbol of a renaissance, others see as a symbol of terror and injustice. Hopefully, as Eleanor said, this memorial can begin a dialogue of healing and reconciliation for our community. Thank you so much to our studio sponsor, the Chattanooga Public Library and Dynamo Studios, and a big thank you to my producer on this episode, Chrissy Varnell of the Chattanooga Public Library. If you all are enjoying the podcast, then please do me a favor, go online wherever you download the podcast and leave us a rating and a review. Thank you all for being here, and we'll see you again next week with an episode on Marcus Shaw, the new executive director of CoLab. Until then, I hope you have a great week.